As we journeyed through the Gospel of Mark, we ended it in verse 33 with Mark chapter 8, where Jesus had just strongly rebuked Peter and the rest of the apostles as well, but specifically Peter, because of what he had said. And if we go back to that, what the Lord said. But turning around and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not setting your mind on God's interest, but man's." And that was because Peter began to rebuke the Lord after he had confessed that he was the Christ, because of what Jesus was beginning to tell them, that he must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. And we know from what Matthew tells us in the parallel passage there that Peter told him, "Never, Lord. Never will it be so." And that's why Jesus said what he did to Peter here. But now, what he does as a direct result of that, Jesus has strongly rebuked Peter and the rest of the apostles. Excuse me. And now he turns not just to the 12, not just to the apostles, but he also turns to the multitude. And he begins to speak to them. Excuse me. And what he says is rather startling, to say the least. This is, to me, one of the most important texts in the Gospel of Mark and the parallel passages which are found in Matthew chapter 16, verses 24 through 25. Actually, a little bit before that. And in Luke chapter 9, verses 23 through 27. One of the most important texts in the Gospels of all. Now, why is that? Well, let's look at our text. This morning, we're going to read from Mark chapter 8, verses 34 to verse 1 of chapter 9. And then we're going to unpack it. And he summoned the crowd, the multitude, with his disciples, with the apostles together, and said to them, "If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul?" It could be translated as well, his life. "For what will a man give in exchange for his soul, for his very life? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will also be ashamed of him when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels." And Jesus was saying to them, verse 1 goes along with it, with the rest of the chapter, like I've said before, when the Bible was first, when these letters were, and the Gospels were first written, there were no verses as such. They were letters. translators have put the verses in. So verse 1 goes along with the ending of chapter 8. And Jesus was saying to them, truly, I say to you, there are some of those who are standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God after it has come with power. Now, before we delve into this, let's look at the parallel passages. If you turn back to Matthew chapter 16, Matthew records it this way. Then Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and will then repay every man according to his deeds. Truly I say to you, there are some of those who are standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. And then we know what Luke has to say about this. In Luke chapter 9, Luke adds his own account, and what he says here, he adds a little word there that we don't find in Matthew and Mark. And he was saying to them all, if anyone wishes to come after me, excuse me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily, and follow me. Whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake, he is the one who will save it. For what is a man profited if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? For whoever is ashamed of me and my word, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his glory and the glory of the Father and of the holy angels. But I say to you truthfully, there are some of those standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God. Now, so we see how it parallels and how those passages are in harmony with one another, and we see some of the differences there. But I submit to you this morning that what we see here in this text and what Jesus is trying to get across and what he's telling the apostles and even what he's telling the multitude is this. You want to follow me? You make the decision to follow me? There are some implications in following me. You want to be one of my disciples? A disciple in what that means is not just a follower, but it means one who is a witnessing learner. Not just follow. And Jesus says, you want to do that? There's some imperatives that go along with that. There's some things that must happen and must go along with that. And in verse 34, he lays out the first thing. He summons the crowd with his disciples, and he said, if anyone wishes to come after me, that is what he's talking about is, they just talked about how he is the Messiah. He is the Christ. Peter and the rest of the apostles, as well as that multitude, have a wrong idea about the Messiahship. They think he's going to be the king. Well, he is king. But they think he's going to be an earthly king. And that if they follow him, they're going to be part of that kingdom. But Jesus has to disabuse them of their ideas. So what he says is this: if anyone desires to come after me, if anyone desires to follow me, then this is what you must do. He must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Self-denial is paramount. It's an imperative in being a disciple of Jesus Christ. Now, I submit to you that even in Jesus' day, that would not be popular for sure, would it not? What Jesus said to them, do you think that would be popular when they heard that? And the multitudes heard that. What? Deny self? What in the world are you talking about, Jesus? Why, we've never heard of such a thing. That was not something that was talked about in Jesus' day. This is a novel idea. This is a novel concept. Even with the apostles being with Jesus for 3 years now, they had never heard this. And Jesus said, you want to follow me? You have a desire to follow me? That's what it means to come after me. Then you deny yourself. Notice something here. Jesus is not only talking to the 12 apostles. He's speaking to the multitude there as well. Or maybe some of those in the multitude wanted to follow him. But they had the wrong idea about who he was. So Jesus is speaking to them as well. Maybe potential followers, disciples. You want to do that? You have desire to do that? You deny yourself. To illustrate this, I'm going to give you an illustration from J.P. Moreland in his book, Love Your God with All Your Mind, The Role of Reason in the Life of the Soul. Good illustration. He says, have you ever inadvertently looked at the sun and then closed your eyes? I have. Sometimes you think it's a foolish thing to do, but I remember doing that. What did you see? Most likely two spots. Have you ever tried to examine those spots? He says, I did once. I was immediately presented with a difficulty. When I closed my eyes and tried to focus my attention on the spot, they would move. Ever experienced that? I have. They would move and stay at a place in my visual field just ahead of the center of my focus. After a minute of chasing the spots around in my consciousness, I finally figured out what to do. I looked past the spots and focused my attention on a point in the background. When I did this, the spots stabilized and came into focus in the foreground of my awareness. And then listen to what he said. Because this has to do with what we're talking about this morning. According to Jesus of Nazareth, our lives are very much like these spots. If we spend all of our time trying to look directly at ourselves, our lives dart around, become unstable, and get drastically out of focus. However, if we deny ourselves daily for Christ's sake, that is, if we gaze past ourselves and stare at him with dedication and affection. As a byproduct, we come into focus and stabilize in the foreground. This sort of self-denial actually requires a strong, integrated self. An immature, fragmented, narcissistic person cannot bring himself or herself to live with that sort of focus and discipline. Brothers and sisters, folks, self-denial is paramount. It's an imperative of discipleship. This is a difficult concept to get a hold of, especially in our day and age. What do people strive for today? What do they think their purpose is? Many people think about, well, what am I going to do for a living? They are young people when they graduate. What am I going to do for a living? What's my career going to be? Someday I want a home. Get married. Have children. Some people think about that today. Not so much, I don't think. The people did. And there's still people who do still think of those things today. They want a car, a vehicle, you know, some sort of a vehicle, a car, a truck, motorcycle, what have you. Clothes. We name all kinds of things. And television and the media today is a good culprit in that, is it not? And think we have to have all those things to survive. J.P. Moreland brings out in this book that what that ends up causing, though, is what psychologists call the empty self. And he says, he lays out for us here what the empty self is. He says there's seven traits of it. And see if you can, when you think about this now, see if you can identify this in our society today. With people. He says the traits of the empty self are that the empty self is individualistic. What does he mean by that? Well, individualistic means that I'm thinking about myself. Me, myself, and I. That's what's important. A second trait is that the empty self is infantile. I'll give you an example of what he says about that. You go, and I don't want to go into all the details with all these things, because there's a lot there. But in going back to the first one, he gives a good example here. He says a few years ago, he was sitting in an elementary school gym with other parents at a DARE graduation, a public school program designed to help children say no to drugs. Remember that? Don't hear about that much today. For his daughter's sixth grade class, five sixth graders were about to read brief papers expressing their reasons for saying no to drugs. He says he leaned over to a couple sitting next to him, and he said to them, each paper, he said, will be a variation of the same reason for refusing to take drugs. Self-interest. And he said, sure enough, student after student said he or she would refuse drugs. Why? Because of a desire to stay healthy. Self-interest. Because they wanted to be a good athlete. Self-interest, because they wanted to go to college. Self-interest, they wanted to do well in school. Self-interest. interest. Conspicuous by its absence was one single reference to virtue or duty to community. Not one student in their papers and what they talked about said they would not do drugs because of the shame it would bring to themselves, to their family, or the community. He says individualistic reasons were the only ones given, a fact to be expected in a generation whose moral education is exhausted by values clarification. By contrast, when a Japanese ice skater, we were talking about this this morning, I referenced Japan, Tina brought that up, and here's a good example. By contrast, when a Japanese ice skater fell during an Olympic performance a few years ago, her main concern was not the endorsement she lost. What was her main concern? Her main concern was that she feared the shame that she had brought on her family and people. The Japanese is an honor shame culture. Community looms large in their way of thinking, and how they understood their sense of self. So the envy self is that way. Self-interest. The empty self is also infantile. The infantile person is controlled by infantile cravings and constantly seeks to be filled up with and made whole by food, by entertainment, and consumer goods. Do we see our society pushing that? Do we not? The empty self is narcissistic and spiritually there are Christian narcissists too. Spiritually, the narcissist, what happens? The narcissist dethrones God and his purposes in history from the center of their life. And what do they replace them with? They replace it with his or own personal fulfillment. The empty self is also passive. What do you mean by that? The passive empty self is in search of pleasure and consumer goods provided by others. Why do you think all these magazines and what you see on television is so prominent? Like People and Us. People, Us, what are those magazines about? If you read them, it's about the empty self. Entertainment Tonight, the celebrity talk shows and all those things, like The View. And here's a thing that you won't hear as well. And I believe he is correct in this. The idea of a Christian celebrity, that's an oxymoron. But they say we have them. My goodness, people, they have made even some megachurch pastors celebrities, have they not? That's an oxymoron. Christian celebrity? Are you kidding me? But for the passive empty self, that's a spiritual life support system. And the empty self is also sensate. In other words, it's all about feelings. It's all about your senses. And then the empty self has lost the art of developing an interior life. And then the seventh, the empty self is hurried and busy. He says that what has resulted in that, and I agree with him, is that a society with empty selves, now think about this, a society with empty self is a morally bankrupt, intellectually shallow society. He cites one example. And we have this going on today, by the way. Many people approach the abortion debate not on the basis of a thoughtful analysis of the relevant arguments, but from an infantile craving to seek promiscuous sexual soothing of the empty self, free from any responsibility or consequences. Is that not true? Is that not why they say, it's my body, I'll do with it what I want with it. It's mine. But they want to be free from the responsibility and the consequences. And he says, moreover, a church with largely empty selves is contrary to the nature and the mature follower of Jesus Christ. The empty self is also the enemy of the Christian mind and its cultivation. And that's what Jesus is talking about here. Self-denial is paramount. Now we might ask, what has all of this got to do with us? I would submit to you that it is a matter, and this is what Jesus is talking about, I would submit to you that it is a matter of life and death. This goes back to what I was talking about in the series in Romans. It comes down to this: the Lord's way or man's way? The Lord's way or my way? It comes down to this, and why this is so important, and we've got to get our, wrap our minds around this and get others to think about this. It's not enough just to believe. It's not enough just to say, I believe in Jesus. It's not enough to go through, and that's what the Hebrew writer is getting through in Hebrews in chapter 6 and in 5. It's not enough to fulfill and complete the plan of salvation. What happens after that? What happened after you arise from the waters of baptism? You say, well, we receive the Holy Spirit. But what happens then? What do we do? See, what they're not doing in so many of the churches today is getting our brothers and sisters and getting Christians to think, to develop the mind, the renewal of the mind. That's what Paul said. It's what is so important. But before we can do that, brothers and sisters, before we can get there, Jesus would have us think differently. And how he wants us to think differently, where it has got to start, is a denial of self. Now, I know that's a hard thing for us to wrap our minds around and for us to think about. Now, this is something that Debbie and I were talking about the other day. Jesus is not talking about self-hate here. He's not talking about hating self. When he says to deny yourself, he's not saying that we are to hate ourselves. He's not saying that we are to denigrate ourselves, denigrate our bodies, or what have you, in thinking of that way. He does not mean that. That's not his point. Neither does he mean that we are not to take care of ourselves. Someone asked me, said, well, and Debbie and I were talking about that, and she brought this up. What does Jesus mean that we're not supposed to go to the doctor then? You know, we're not supposed to take care of ourselves. We're supposed to deny self. That's not what he means at all. If he meant that, then he would be contradicting himself when you read what you read in Matthew chapter 22, verse 39. You see, if we think this way, Eric, you're going to say something? What's that? Mm-hmm. Correct. That's part of it. That's part of it. And again, you read what he says in Matthew chapter 22, verse 39, what he tells them, what are we supposed to do? We are supposed to love our neighbor as we do what? As we love ourselves. And to love God with all of our mind, soul, and strength. Get that? Mind, soul, strength, mind. The renewal of the mind. If we think this way, that we are to hate self and to hate ourselves, then we are missing the Lord's teaching here. What he is saying, we have value. We have worth. We have meaning and purpose. Why did Jesus come? Why did he die? Because he sees and he knows the value of us, the worth of us. That's why he died, for that. But when he says deny self, he's not talking about that. And Eric has hit up on a good point, because as we go on, he says, to deny yourself means you take up your cross, and Luke tells us you do that daily. Well, what does that mean? A lot of people say, well, I'll buy a cross and I'll start wearing it. You know, we'll put the cross on the building. There you go. And we're wearing a cross, we're taking up our cross. That's not what he means either. It's become a fashion symbol. It's correct. We know that, but it's wrong. And that's not what he's talking about either. Jesus is using imagery here that the multitude and the 12 would have understood. But it would not go over very well either. The cross was well known as an instrument of death, that it was used for criminals and for those who were treasonous to the state. Very gruesome form of execution. And again, most of the people in that time, in the area, as well as the Roman Empire, and even in the Jewish lands, for the Jews, it was an honor-shame culture. You're hanging upon a cross being executed. What are people going to do? Just like what they did to Jesus. Mock him. It's humiliating. It's a form of public disgrace. The Jews were appalled at this. That's why what we read in Deuteronomy chapter 21, verses 21 through 22, and what Paul said in Galatians chapter 3, verse 13. You read that, what Paul says. Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law, having become a curse for us, for it is written. And that comes from Deuteronomy chapter 21. Cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. To the Jews, the cross was repugnant. They would have been appalled at that. But here comes Jesus, and he uses that for his purposes. Why? Think about it. Jesus is telling them and us today that the self cannot be the center of your life. And if it is, it results in an empty self. And on all those traits. See, what Jesus is telling them, and it goes back to what Eric was talking about. If you look back to Romans chapter 6, what Paul says there, what should we say then? Are we to continue in sin so that grace may increase? Maganarta, may it never be. How shall we who died to sin still live in it? Or do you not know that all of us who have been immersed into Christ Jesus have been immersed, baptized into his death? Therefore, we have been buried with him through baptism into death, so that as Christ was raised from the dead through the glory of the Father, so we too might walk in newness of life. At our baptism, that begins. For if we have become united with him in the likeness of his death, certainly we shall also be in the likeness of his resurrection. Knowing this, that our old self was crucified with him, in order that our body of sin might be done away with, so that we would no longer be slave to sin. We must do this in order to follow him. Again, when you read this, this is an imperative. Jesus is not making a suggestion here. He's saying, if you want to follow after me, if you want to come after me, if you want to follow me, then deny self. Take yourself off the throne. Instead of doing things your way, you know, like Frank Sinatra saying, and now he's gone, and you can imagine what his way has ended up in. He said, I did it my way. He's saying that. Remember that song? How popular that was? And many people still think that's all great. So great. I did it my way. And God said, do it your way. But when you do it your way, you're gonna face the consequences. And that's what Jesus is saying here. He's not, again, making a suggestion. Jesus is saying that to follow him completely, there are no halfway measures. As the old saying goes, Jesus is either Lord of all, that means of all of our lives, of all of our being, or he is not Lord at all. There's no halfway measures with him. As Brother Nofel Satan says, to take up the cross means, at the very minimum, that we are willing to die to selfishness and live for God. It means, at the very minimum, that we take into our lives what we witnessed Jesus did on the cross. Now, that doesn't mean that what Jesus is saying here, that we literally have to die on a cross. That's not what he's saying. But what he did on the cross and why he did it. And now comes an interesting section in our text where Jesus asked a couple of questions here that we need to unpack. And he does this in the form of rhetoric. And now, at first glance, when you read these questions, they seem to be rather audacious, do they not? And perhaps one could say self-contradictory. But they're not. They are indeed what the Lord intends. So let's consider these. The first question he asks is paradoxical in nature. He says, "For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel will save it. For what does it profit a man, a person, male or female, to gain the whole world and forfeit his life?" Heavy question, isn't it? There's a paradox there. What does he mean? For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it. Does that mean that you have to die to save your life? But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. And then he answers that question, and he answers what he says, the statement he makes, when he says the first question, which is a paradox here. I mean, you think about this. Can you imagine what the disciples, the apostles, and the multitude were thinking when he said this? Because he reinforces that with another question. For what will a man give in exchange for his life? For his soul. I don't know about you, but I find these questions rather sobering, to say the least. It reminds me of what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 10, verses 32 through 33. Whoever wishes to save his life will lose it. You know what he's saying there? If you don't want to deny self, if you want to continue to keep self on the throne, and you want to continue to do things your way, not his way, you're going to lose your life. He's talking about eternity, folks. That's what he's talking about. You can continue to go. People can continue to do whatever they want to do. They can do things their way, not even think about God, not think about Jesus, not even have anything to do with Him. And at the end of their life, what's going to happen? Will they gain eternity? No. That's what Jesus means. What He means is you hang on to the world and you become conformed to the world and mold how the world does things. Like what's happening? You're going to end up losing your life. You'll lose eternity. People aren't thinking about that, are they? Because they become themselves. But he says, what does it profit a person to gain the whole world? Because if you gain the whole world, you end up forfeiting your life. But if we'll take self, if we'll do self-denial, and it's a hard thing. Every time we're talking about that and said, well, said, how are we doing on self-denial? Well, that's a good question, is it not? It's a hard thing, is it not? It's not something for us to get down on ourselves about. It's something to think about because it has to do with the renewing of our minds. How Jesus would have us to think, what He wants us to become, that He wants us to become like Him. See? But it takes that denial of self, and it's a hard thing. I was telling them, he said, we wrestle with that. As Christians, we do. And we wrestle with that day after day after day. It's a battle. Being a Christian, we are in a battle. And it is a battle with not only with the world and others who are outside of Christ, but it's a battle within as well. It's a battle with self. But we must continue to fight that battle, to deny self, to take ourselves off the throne and put Him on the throne and strive to keep Him there. That's what He is talking about here. Notice what He says in verse 38, which goes back to what He said we find in Matthew chapter 10, verse 32 through 33. So then He says, "For what will a man give in exchange for his soul, for his life? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation," are we not living in still and in adulterous and sinful generation? And notice what He says, "For whoever is ashamed of me and my words, the Son of Man will also be ashamed of him when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels." And then He says, and Jesus was saying to them, "Truly I say to you, there's some of you who are standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God after it has come with power." When did that happen? Day of Pentecost. What's that, Jeff? I didn't hear that. What's that? Yes. On the day of Pentecost, the church came in power. The Spirit came upon the apostles. The church began. Christ's kingdom, His reign began. But then He also talks about when He comes with His holy angels. And what he means there, what He's talking about, is yes, His second coming. But He's saying that if you're ashamed of me and my words, if you do not deny and do this, the imperatives of discipleship, what He says, I will not acknowledge you before my Father. That's a heavy thing. And if he doesn't, what's the result? Just what He says. You lose eternity. Here's what the apostles needed to learn, as well as those who would follow Jesus in His day. A wrong view of who He is and why He came and what He did leads to a wrong concept of discipleship, of following Him. And brothers and sisters, that pertains to us today as well. We're going to stand and we're going to sing, "I have decided to follow Jesus." When we sing this, we should think deeply about those words. When we decide to follow Jesus, there's no turning back. None. That's why the world has to be behind us. But we have to continue to fight that battle of self-denial. That's important, that we continue to fight that battle in order that we can strive to bring others to that same place.